Hello, everybody, and especially you blockheads. This is Paul Boyer. Welcome to the Mad Money Machine Season 2, Episode 6 for Friday, June 20th, 2014. There's a lot of Bitcoin news to cover, and the California trip, and the download woes, and the U.S. Marshals, all here on the Mad Money Machine.
Broadcasting from the Bitcoin bunker, six blocks below, brandishing the blockchain to fight good versus evil. This is Bitcoin versus the man. This is the battle of the century. This is the Mad Money Machine.
The Mad Money Machine is grateful for your support and the support of Brokker.com. Before you buy anything on the internet, broker it at Brokker.com. Spend your bitcoins, get a discount, or buy bitcoins with your credit card or PayPal. A couple of Thursdays ago, when I was somewhere on the PCH between Monterey and Cambria, I got a, and when I was in cell service, I got a Wallet HQ instant alert that said, let me pull it up here, on June 12th at 1900 GMT, address DPR spent 100,000 millibit coins, I guess 100 million millibit coins, or 100,000 bitcoins. And then I got another one that the same address spent 44,000 bitcoins. And at first I looked at that number, you know, I've got these Wallet HQ alerts set up for when people support the Mad Money Machine. And I thought, wow, somebody really gave a lot to the Mad Money Machine. Yeah, that'd be a lot. A total of $88 million, I think that would be. That's the U.S. Marshals have moved money from one Bitcoin address to another Bitcoin address. I'm not sure why they did that. It was a coincident with their announcement that they're going to auction off the Silk Road Bitcoins. And there's two addresses that they hold. One is for the Silk Road seized bitcoins, and the other one is for the DPR seized bitcoins. They're not auctioning off the DPR seized bitcoins yet. That's the $88 million worth. They are auctioning off the Silk Road bitcoins, worth at today's market value of $607 per bitcoin. It would be worth about $18 million if they got that price for them. First of all, why do they send it to just one Bitcoin address? One single Bitcoin address holds all of those 18 million and the other one, $88 million worth of Bitcoins at today's market value. Whew, would you like to be the guy that pushes the enter button on that transfer? I hope they had multi-sig or something going on. I mean, I would be reading off every single a character in the 32-bit long Bitcoin address string twice or three times before pressing the enter button, just to absolutely make sure I'm not sending it to some address that I don't have control over. You know, I would first send a dollar's worth of Bitcoin, you know, send $1 from this address to this address, boom. Yes, I got it. Yes, I can get to it. Yes, I can get the private key to unlock it. I see the dollar. It's under my control. Now send the rest. They apparently didn't do that. They just sent it all in one shot. And judging by their performance on how they run email, that seems kind of risky, because what they did was, you know, in holding this auction, they had interested parties email them questions about, you know, how will the auction be run, and we'll answer your questions. Just email us. So they sent back an email reply, but they included all of the email addresses in the CC line, not the BCC line. So everybody could see who everybody else was that asked questions about the Bitcoin auction. And these people included Barry Silbert at CEO for Second Market, along with Michael Morrow at director at Second Market. Lefner Lowe, director of public policy for Yelp. Malcolm Oluswami, chairperson of Little Phoenix Investment Group. A quantitative arbitrage at BNP, a co-founder of CEO of Bitcoin Shop, co-founder of Coinbase, Fred Ersham. And the list of names goes on there. These were people that emailed the U.S. Marshals Service, and the U.S. Marshals Service emailed them back in the clear. How security aware the U.S. Marshals are. I saw a very funny tweet from the fake Twitter account, Satoshi Nakamoto, saying, I don't think I'm going to enter in the auction. I'll just wait till they email out the private keys to everybody, to the winners. Oh, my goodness. But can you imagine sending 18 or even the $88 million from one Bitcoin address to another?
And you know how much in fees they paid to transfer $18 million?
They paid $4.02 to transfer $18 million from one Bitcoin address to another one.
Well, let's hear what they had to say about this on Bloomberg.com.
Okay, so does this, I mean, I imagine this, Alex, helps generate some buzz for Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first time a federal government, I believe, has auctioned off Bitcoin, which is pretty remarkable as a historical moment. The way they're doing it is interesting. They're sort of breaking it out into blocks so that one person can't buy all of it.
I think what he meant to say there is so that one person doesn't have to buy all of it. One person certainly can buy all of it if they bid high enough for all the blocks.
And they're also doing it in tranches. So,
not sure what he means by also doing it in tranches. He just said they're doing it in blocks. Isn't that good enough?
I think overall they're doing it the right way.
Now, this is where I'm not sure whether they are, in fact, doing it the right way. If by right way you mean the easiest way for them to do it, yeah, this is probably one of the easiest ways. I guess the absolute easiest way to do it is just to sell all the coins in one shot, one big auction. That would be the easiest way. The next easiest way is to break them up into 10 blocks, which is basically what they've done here. They're selling 9 blocks of 3,000 bitcoins and 1 block of the remainder, 2,600 some bitcoins. You know, the easiest way may not be the best way, though, because if you want to get the most possible money for the bitcoins that you're selling, you might open it up to the public to buy them. You might open it up for, you know, might develop a system where the average Joe Schmo investor can buy them. Maybe set a price for them, set the market price for them, and allow people to pay for them with their bank account or credit card. So I'm not sure it's the best way. It's probably just one of the easiest ways. It's going to be interesting to see, and I don't know whether we will see or not, but it will be interesting to try to find out who the winner of this auction will be, or who the winners will be, and how much they paid for these bitcoins. There's a couple of different schools of thought here. One is there's a very limited market of buyers that could. First of all, you have to put up $200,000 just to get in to bid, and you have to wire that money to them ahead of time. And of course, you have to have the money to buy the block of 3,000 bitcoins, which 3,000 bitcoins, let me just use even numbers at a price of, let's say $600 times 600, what is that? $1.8 million. You put up $200,000, you have to have the balance of $1.8 million to be able to buy this block. But it'll be interesting to see what kind of price this limited number of buyers can get for this block of bitcoins. You'd think if there's a limited amount of buyers, they might get a pretty good price for the bitcoins. On the other hand, where else are you going to buy 3,000 bitcoins at a time? And so there's a limited seller's market for these bitcoins as well. That is, there aren't that many places where you can just, in one big swoop, buy 3,000 bitcoins. So I can see a case for the price could be low, lower than $600 a bitcoin, or it could be high. It could be higher than $600 a bitcoin because of the convenience to the buyer of getting them all in one place. So it's going to be very interesting to see what the U.S. Marshals get for the bitcoins. I had mentioned on previous shows that I was going to be taking a trip to California at some time in the future. Well, last week was the week that we took the big trip to California. And it was also partially part of the reason why some of the downloads didn't work, because I wasn't on the internet to be able to fix things quickly. Let's Talk Bitcoin kind of changed the way they handle downloads. They used to put all the, they used to take my MP3 file and put it on their SoundCloud account. And right before I left for California, they changed it and said, host it yourself. Yeah, I'm all right with that. And I thought my host could handle it, but I was wrong. And my host just could not handle it. They don't give me the bandwidth to handle that many simultaneous downloads of such a large file. So I could, make the file a lot smaller. That would be one thing to do, and I'll probably try that. I could pay them quite a large amount of money to upgrade the bandwidth to allow people to download it simultaneously. Or I could get a SoundCloud account, which is probably what I will do, and probably what I've already done by the time this show is delivered. Get a SoundCloud account, publish the files to SoundCloud, and of course I have to pay money now. I think it's $15 a month for one of the pro accounts to allow unlimited downloads so that you can get all the old Mad Money machines as well as the newest one. But I was in California at the time. Now, a brief synopsis of our trip. We spent 10 days in California, flew into Los Angeles, drove immediately to Vasquez Rocks, and spent maybe an hour there. These are the rocks that are used in a lot of movies when they need an alien territory, like Star Trek, and actually The Big Bang Theory. They dressed up in their Star Trek costumes and went to Vasquez Rocks, although I'm not sure. They may have been on a green screen. We spent some time there. Then we went to the Sequoia National Park and saw the big, big trees. Spent one night, I believe, there. I had a kind of a cold that day. We climbed up to Morro Rock, where I think I had AT&T cell service again for a few minutes. We went on a little hike through the woods there in the Sequoia National Park early in the morning. I think it was about 8 a.m. Nobody else around. We wandered off the paved path into a dirt path, which was going to be much longer way around back to the parking lot, probably, I don't know, 3 miles or something. And about a third of the way through, I said to the family, this is just too long. Let's go back and go the other way. I turned back. They kind of followed me. About 30 yards later, I looked around a bush, and there on the trail was a golden bear. a light-colored bear, at which point I froze. I put my hand in the sort of the halt signal, slowly backed up along the trail, turned around and said, bear, bear. And we walked very fast in the original direction all the way around the 3 mile trail, anxiously looking for friends of the light colored bear along our path. Now, if I hadn't seen so many signs in the parking lot saying, do not approach bears, then I might not have been as cautious as we were. I might have stopped to take a picture. I might have let the family come up closer to me and see it for themselves. But instead, I opted for caution, and we went the other way. I didn't even report the sighting. I should have reported the sighting to someone in authority there, just to let them know, hey, there's a bear in your woods, as if they didn't know. Well, we left Sequoia the next day, or was it that day? It's all a big blur. Drove through Bakersfield, which was over 100 degrees. Then the straight shot, the straight line road through orange groves and other agricultural sections to Fresno. Had our In-N-Out burger experience in Fresno, also over 100 degrees, to then make our way up into Yosemite. Yosemite was amazingly beautiful. Spent a couple nights there in the Curry campsite. We opted for the more civilized accommodations, not the tents there. Fortunately, we'd booked early. There's one building there where you can get Wi-Fi if you're early enough. If you go late in the day and everybody else is there with their Wi-Fi, you just can't get on, can't get on the Wi-Fi. Did a lot of hiking and climbing and viewing and waterfalls and went to Mirror Lake, which wasn't at all very good, but went to Yosemite Falls and went to the Glacier Dome and hiked up to the top of a bunch of other domes and looked out 360-degree views of beautiful Yosemite National Park. Left early in the morning on the Tuesday then, very early as we could. We got up at 5 a.m., I think, probably the only car on the road at sunrise, to try to get to Google. Yes, we found someone to give us a private tour of Google. Mark, who knew somebody, Ron, who worked at Google. Mark hooked me up with Ron, who worked at Google, for a private tour, although Ron was on vacation the week that we were going to be there. So I asked Ron, you know, is there anybody else that you know at Google that could give us a tour? He said, yeah, I wouldn't really want to do that for a stranger. And I said, well, I'm really into Bitcoin. Is there anybody there that's really into Bitcoin? We wouldn't be strangers. So he hooked me up with another guy named Mark. And we got a private tour of Google. We met Mark at one of the satellite buildings there on the Google campus. And we all got on our Google bikes. They just leave bikes laying around at the various satellite buildings. Got on our Google bikes and rode over to the main building on campus, where we went on a little mini tour through some of the buildings and things. And we got our Google lunch. We actually got a free lunch at Google. You just go in, take your tray and a plate, and pick up anything you want to eat at all. Nobody buys food at Google. We went to the Google souvenir store, the Google employee shop, and bought t-shirts. You know, been there, done that, got the t-shirt. But then while we were eating, Mark was telling us about his Bitcoin background. Lo and behold, there are some Googlers that are deep into Bitcoin. Mark, in 2010, had got interested in Bitcoin. He started mining Bitcoin. He used graphics cards, and he started building mining rigs. And they started selling mining rigs, and he started a company selling Bitcoin mining rigs. And you can imagine what a difficult business selling Bitcoin mining rigs must be. He did sell several of them, but then left that opportunity to go work for Google, and is happily employed there. And what a neat place to be. I think everyone there is, I don't know, 25 years old or younger, it appeared. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe 35 years old or younger. Everybody was young. If you've ever worked in government contracting in the D.C. area, you see a lot of gray beards, as they call them. A lot of senior people. We didn't see so many senior people at the Google complex. That was a real treat, and I appreciate that. I thank you guys so much for giving us that tour and taking the time to show us around. Then we headed immediately over to Stanford University and got a tour there from one of the freshmen who's from Richmond, Virginia. Gave us a really nice walking tour around the Stanford University campus. And then after driving all that way from Yosemite to Google to Stanford, we drove all the way down to Monterey. Fortunately, we got in the carpool lane, so we were a bit faster than all the other Googlers going home. Stayed a couple nights in Monterey and got to walk around Pebble Beach Golf Course. What a treat that was for me. Took pictures of most of the golf holes there. Didn't play golf because it costs $495 to play 18 holes of golf there. So walking around it and looking was a lot better value for us. We ate lunch there at Pebble Beach, overlooking the very first tee. Had a great lunch. Probably my favorite meal in California. Took the 17-mile drive and saw all the various rocks and things, meeting the ocean. Kind of shortened this travelogue up for you. We then went to drive all along the Pacific Coast Highway down to Cambria, where we stayed, was it one or two nights? I can't remember. Probably one night. Went to the Hearst Castle the next morning, took a tour of that. Wasn't really looking forward to that. I thought, nah, I just want, you know, this, I don't want to really want to see some rich guy's stuff. But it turns out he had a lot of collectible antiques there. And those were very interesting to see. Left there and took the big drive down to Marina del Rey, where we stayed the balance of our vacation. Got to tour around Venice Beach and Hollywood. And what I'm just finding out then is this Saturday, tomorrow, RoboCoin ATMs for Bitcoin will be installed in Venice Beach and in Hollywood. And we just missed it. I was looking for any signs of Bitcoin anywhere we went. The national parks having no internet service, there was not a very good chance we would see Bitcoin there. Bitcoin's not a known commodity at Stanford like it is at MIT. Bitcoin, you know, it was good to talk to Mark at Google about Bitcoin. But we didn't see Bitcoin signs anywhere in California. We didn't see them in Venice Beach. We didn't see them in Hollywood. Bitcoin accepted here. But maybe with that Bitcoin ATM going in at Venice Beach, maybe you guys will start to see Bitcoin accepted here signs in the various junk shops along the strip there. I do appreciate the tweets from some of you guys who said, hey, you're in LA. Why don't you stop by and see us? Well, we just had our whole week planned out and didn't have any free time for doing that. Wish I'd have done that, though. I wish I would have mentioned on the show that I was going to be in L.A. as well as up in Google and could have met up with some folks, talk about some Bitcoin. It would have been fun. And you could have shown us around a little bit of what's the important things to see in Los Angeles. Man, Los Angeles is big. Whew. The last Sunday when we were there, we took a van tour. Had a driver drive us around about 5 hours worth of driving around Los Angeles, Hollywood, of course, Rodeo Drive, Hancock Park, the Disney Concert Hall, and the oldest house still surviving in Los Angeles in a little Mexican village down there. And after that, we went to Griffith Park to observe LA from above. It was a great trip. We saw a lot of California, drove 1,350 miles over those 10 days in a great big loop. Ah, but it's good to be back home. So I asked Mark at Google, are you guys doing anything regarding Bitcoin? And he said that, yeah, they had looked at putting some price information about Bitcoin on the Google sites, but hadn't really done anything. Well, lo and behold, a couple of days later, we find out that yes, indeed, Yahoo Finance and Google Finance both report Bitcoin prices. You can go to finance.google.com and type in currency Bitcoin or BTC and get a chart history, just like you would of a stock, of the Bitcoin prices. But the tool this week is something that I don't even think was announced, that I just kind of went in and hacked around and found out that you can do. You can now go into your Google spreadsheet, and just like getting a current stock price, you can have automatically inserted into your Google spreadsheet the current Bitcoin price in dollars, or perhaps other currencies. I haven't tried it. Here's the way it works. Simply enter into your Google spreadsheet the following formula. Equals Google Finance, parentheses, quote, currency colon BTC USD, end quote, in parentheses. That will insert the current Bitcoin value. I think they get it from Coinbase. It's really cool if you're kind of keeping track of your Bitcoin net worth. Give it a shot. Google Finance's automatically updated Bitcoin price. Like the best things in life, it's free. Well, have you got FIFA fever yet? I have to admit, you know, I don't really watch a whole lot of soccer in my normal day-to-day TV viewing habits. But for some reason, I'm really hooked on FIFA, on the World Cup. I was watching Cameroon versus, who was it even the other day? Croatia. Cameroon versus Croatia, a match that meant nothing. Basically, the loser went home. That was the only thing the match meant. But I couldn't stop watching it. Great thing about sports is it's real, live, compelling, emotional drama. And after all, soccer is the beautiful game. We did, while we were in California, take time out to watch USA win their opening match over Ghana 2-1. Well, they scored their first goal within 32 seconds. And then they didn't score their second goal until practically the end of the match, after Ghana had tied it late in the game. Well, if you've got FIFA fever like me, what you need to do is get yourself an official team jersey. Place to do that, of course, is DicksSportingGoods.com. And sorry, Dick's Sporting Goods doesn't accept Bitcoin, but if you use one of the supporters of Mad Money Machine, you can spend Bitcoin and get your official FIFA team jersey. All you need to do is go to Brawker.com, Brawker.com, set up an account, load it up with some Bitcoins, and then go into the tab that says Spend Bitcoins, paste in the URL there for the Dick's Sporting Goods online gift certificate, indicate the amount that you want that gift certificate to hold, then choose your discount. Adjust the slider anywhere between 0%, no discount, or 20% discount. The discount will be charged to the buyer on the other side. Then put in your email address that you want that gift certificate sent to, and place your order with Brawker.com. Your order will be visible within the Buy Bitcoins tab. Anyone can buy Bitcoins, buy your Bitcoins, by using their credit card at DicksSportingGoods.com to buy that gift certificate for you. Send it to your email address, and everybody wins. They get the Bitcoins, you get the official FIFA team jersey. Give it a try. Brawker.com. Also like to thank the Vertcoin community who sent 93 Vertcoin. Vertcoin is the first truly ASIC-resistant cryptocurrency that aims to bring control back to the hands of the people instead of being controlled by a few centralized entities. Vertcoin features the ability to be merge mined with other coins, including Monocle, a live cryptocurrency that was designed for the development and real-world testing of new features to be implemented within the Vertcoin protocol itself. The Vertcoin development team is busy testing and will be introducing stealth addresses at the end of the month. Vertcoin has a market cap of over $3.5 million, perhaps the largest peer-to-peer strength of any crypto, and an active community dedicated to merchant adoption, among other things. Not to mention, we love us some Mad Money Machine. Well, thank you. Check out Vertcoin.org for more information, or visit them at the Vertcoin subreddit. I'd like to thank J.J. Phillips of Toronto, who says, if you can program, then you can prove. Go to mathgate.info and get proof that you can prove. He says, P.S. support Mad Money Machine. Well, keep it up, J.J. Phillips, and you'll be part of the Mad Money Machine Hall of Fame supporters. I'd like to thank Rob, Los Angeles. Didn't get to see you when I was out there. He says, love MMM and would love for bkeychain.com. That's the letter B, keychain.com. Bitcoin keychains to be part of what you do. What a bargain advertising platform. Note, up to you if you want to read line 3. Well, go to bkeychain.com and check out Bitcoin keychains. If you'd like to support the Mad Money Machine, go to madmoneymachine.com and click on the donate button over to the right-hand side. You'll get to enter 4 lines of text that I'll read on the show for the low price of 0.1 Bitcoin or more. So to summarize, Brocker.com, got to check that one out. Vertcoin.org, Mathgate.info, and BKeyChain.com. Thank you so much, guys, for supporting the Mad Money Machine. Well, his legs are probably going numb, sitting in the lotus position, but let's go hear what he has to say in Satoshi's Corner.
Satoshi no Corner.
Well, this is from Satoshi's second post out at BitcoinTalk.org. An excerpt from it, just a small posting. He said, "A lot of people automatically dismiss e-currency as a lost cause because of all the companies that failed since the 1990s. I hope it's obvious. It was only the centrally controlled nature of those systems that doomed them. I think this is the first time we're trying a decentralized, non-trust-based system." And that was posted February 15th, 2009. Then 3 days later, on the 18th, he wrote, "It is a globally distributed database with additions to the database by consent of the majority based on a set of rules they follow, including whenever someone finds proof of work to generate a block, they get some new coins. The proof of work difficulty is adjusted every 2 weeks to target an average of 6 blocks per hour for the whole network. And the coins given per block is cut in half every 4 years. You could say coins are issued by the majority. They are issued in a limited, predetermined amount. As an example, if there are 1,000 nodes and 6 get coins each hour, it would likely take a week before you get anything." And then he responds to someone named Sep. He says, to Sep's question, "Indeed, there is nobody to act as a central bank or Federal Reserve to adjust the money supply as the population of users grows. That would have required a trusted party to determine the value, because I don't know a way for software to know the real-world value of things. If there was some clever way, or if we wanted to trust someone to actively manage the money supply to peg it to something, the rules could have been programmed for that. In this sense, it's more typical of a precious metal. Instead of the supply changing to keep the value the same, the supply is predetermined and the value changes. As the number of users grows, the value per coin increases. It has the potential for a positive feedback loop. As users increase, the value goes up, which could attract more users to take advantage of the increasing value." Satoshi Nakamoto. Well, you know, the exchange-traded fund for Bitcoin to be operated by the Winklevoss twins is on the horizon and should be out sometime within the next several months. So you'll be able to go on to the NASDAQ and buy Bitcoin ETF. You know what the next step is going to be, though? You're going to have somebody as a manager who operates a fund that trades in Bitcoin and perhaps other cryptocurrencies. And they're going to try to convince you that their management skills will get you ahead because they'll get in and out of Bitcoin at the right time. Well, don't believe it. Here's step 5 in the 12-step program for active investors. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. A 12-step program for active investors. Step 5, manager pickers. My name is Paul, and I'm an active investor. I needed to select an investment for my 401k plan. Go! And based upon the past performance of some of those mutual funds, there were some glorious days. So I picked the one that was the best performer, but it's all over now. I was amazed at how great life was, but it's not anymore. Now I understand the day I picked that fund, lucky days were over. What'd you do? Don't you understand? The day I found you, I was done. But I'll make it through. I just can't accept this situation. I've been sentenced for arrogance. I'm doing my time, paying for the crime. But I'm ready to carry on.
I can recall some glorious days, but it's all over now. I was amazed how great life was.
situation. I've been sentenced for arrogance. I've done my time, paid for my crime. Now I'm ready to carry on.
Like stock and time picking, manager picking is a worthless endeavor. However, there are still investors out there who believe they can select an all-star manager or financial guru who can beat the odds. Typically, investors first invest in a star fund run by a star manager when they read about the latest and greatest funds. Then they sell their investments within a few years when they become disenchanted by the fund's shoddy performance. Investors are seldom aware that active funds that have good performance histories are always riskier than the indexes they outperform. Also, outstanding performance histories can be surprisingly fragile. Few investors realize that the most important factor separating a winning performance history from a losing one is the choice of starting and ending dates. Finally, outstanding performance histories don't always reflect taxes or commission loads. Published mutual fund ratings are often pre-tax returns that disguise their true after-tax performance in taxable accounts. If you're trying to pick a mutual fund based upon its past performance, if you're trying to select an investment based upon its star rating, we're here to rescue you. We're here to bring you home.
Is there some way you can rescue me? Some way you can bring me home again? Some way you can rescue me? Rescue me.
Yeah, thanks once again to Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com for that content. Well, is Apple back in your graces? Just before I left on vacation, Apple announced, they didn't so much as announce it as revise the terms of their developer specifications to say that it would be okay to allow certain cryptocurrency applications as apps in their online iOS app store for the iPhone and iPad. Well, are they back in your graces now? All the folks that smashed their iPhones and took rifles and shot through their iPhones. Are you going to go rush out now and buy an iPhone? Because Apple should once again allow Bitcoin applications, Bitcoin wallets more specifically, to appear in the App Store. And I hear that there are a couple of them out there. Now, the big ones aren't yet available. Blockchain.info hasn't updated its app yet. I think what they're doing is they're going to kind of revise the original application that they had on the App Store, upgrade it to version 2 and release it. And then we'll be looking for Coinbase to update and upload its application for the App Store. Well, there was more news about Apple and its future of payments. There was an article out at Business Insider, John Hedgestuen and Marcella Balve. June 18th, Apple's plan for the future of payments is coming into focus. They show a chart there of the number of accounts, Apple versus Amazon versus PayPal, and Apple is far and away the leader in the number of accounts over Amazon and PayPal combined, really. And they say that the outlines of an iPhone-centered mobile payment system are beginning to emerge. There are plenty of reasons why Apple could be successful in payments. Starting with their 800 million iTunes customer accounts, most of them already associated with a credit card number. But the expected iPhone 6 launch late this summer or autumn has created expectations of new payments-related phone features. And they say that the BI Intelligence, their research service, they published a research note on where Apple is with mobile payments and where they think it's headed. They believe that Apple's mobile payments system will rest on three basic components. Number one, iPhone mobile payments will center around Touch ID, the fingerprint scanning system. Number two, for offline payments in bricks and mortar retail settings, iPhones will use Bluetooth to beam payment data to beacons, low-cost hardware that attach to walls, shelves, or countertops. And they say with beacons, conventional checkout registers won't be needed. Customers could check out, purchase items, and have their purchases approved through an app as they walk out of a store without ever seeing a clerk, fishing for their wallets, or approaching a payment terminal. And three, payment information would be protected by a process known as tokenization, which means the real credit card information is never exposed, even as payment data is relayed from the phone to the merchant beacon. Well, take that, Bitcoiners! Can you make Bitcoin that easy to use? Ah, we'll see. And that wasn't the extent of Apple in the news. You know, a couple of shows ago, I talked about Proton Mail, a system where folks are trying to generate a completely end-to-end encrypted email system in the browser. There's an article out at 925mac.com by Mark Gurman. Says Apple will soon begin encrypting iCloud email in transit between providers. He said that Apple has informed the network that it is working on an update to its iCloud mail service that encrypts emails in transit from other providers. As of right now, iCloud emails are solely encrypted in transit from one iCloud email account to another. But an email sent from iCloud to Gmail or Yahoo, as examples, or vice versa, is not currently encrypted. And he says this is what will change. Quote, Apple encrypts email from its customers to iCloud. However, Apple is one of the few global email providers based in the U.S. that is not encrypting any of its customers' email in transit between providers. After we published, the company told us this would soon change. This affects users of me.com and mac.com email addresses. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but it's still not quite the end-to-end encryption that we'd really like. The user-to-user encryption of data. Enter Gmail. This article from Google themselves out at googleonlinesecurity.blogspot.com, posted by Stephen Somaggi, product manager for security and privacy. It's called Making End-to-End Encryption Easier to Use. He says, your security online has always been a top priority for us, and we're constantly working to make sure your data is safe. For example, Gmail supported HTTPS when it first launched and now always uses an encrypted connection when you check or send email in your browser. We warn people in Gmail and Chrome when we have reason to believe they're being targeted by bad actors. He said, today, we're adding to that list the alpha version of a new tool. It's called End-to-End, and it's a Chrome extension intended for users who need additional security beyond what we already provide. End-to-end encryption means data leaving your browser will be encrypted until the message's intended recipient decrypts it, and that similarly encrypted messages sent to you will remain that way until you decrypt them in your browser. He goes on to say that while end-to-end encryption tools like PGP and GNU-PG have been around for a long time, they require a great deal of technical know-how and manual effort to use. To help make this kind of encryption a bit easier, we're releasing code for the new Chrome extension that uses OpenPGP, an open standard supported by many existing encryption tools. He goes on to say that, however, you won't find the end-to-end encryption extension in the Chrome Web Store quite yet. We're just sharing the code today so that the community can test and evaluate it, helping us make sure that it's as secure as it needs to be before people start relying on it. And we mean it. Our vulnerability reward program offers financial awards for finding security bugs in Google code, including end-to-end. And then he's got a link to a webpage called code.google.com/p/end-to-end that talks more in detail about this Chrome extension, which says this is the source code for the alpha release of the end-to-end Chrome extension. It's built upon a newly developed JavaScript-based crypto library. End-to-end implements the OpenPGP standard, IETF RFC 4880, enabling key generation, encryption, decryption, digital signature, and signature verification. We're releasing this code to enable community review. It is not yet ready for general use. So yet again, the future is dark, but it's still in the future. They have a set of questions and answers in this document. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. One section's called JavaScript Crypto. Implementing crypto in JavaScript is considered heretical by some. When we started work on end-to-end, there was no JavaScript crypto library that met our needs, so we built our own. During development, we took into consideration all the criticisms and risks that we were aware of and invested effort to mitigate these risks as much as possible. They say, in practice, no common programming language prevents the code from having vulnerabilities. We hold ourselves to a higher standard. We started from scratch and created a testable, modern, cryptographic library. We created this new core library for end-to-end with support for big integer, modular arithmetic, elliptic curve, as well as symmetric and public key encryption. Having done that, we then developed an open PGP implementation on top of it. Well, I think this is very exciting. This is exactly what I was hoping that Gmail would do, is implement something in the browser that allows us to basically implement open PGP. And it's going to be very interesting how it works, because key management is the devil that's in the details. Can we easily manage our PGP keys and get them to the get our public keys to those that want to send us messages and keep our private keys private? Very exciting. Stay tuned to the Madman Machine. We'll keep you updated on the progress of Google and Apple and other dark projects.
You're listening to Paul Boyer's Mad Money Machine.
Yes, you're listening to the Madman Machine, but let's listen more to Bloomberg and Matt Miller.
So what's going on here?
So much is going on with Bitcoin, Betty. And you know what? I spent all night sort of talking to people on Reddit, tweeting with people about it, calling up my buddies who are in venture capital. It's really a number of different things, but the general idea is big corporations, big money, venture capital, even government regulation, everybody seems to be getting behind it. Even television news anchors aren't so cynical anymore as they had been in the past.
Don't look at me.
Let me, you know, you mentioned a few things. Obviously, Apple, if Apple allows Coinbase and other Bitcoin apps onto its ecosystem, that's a huge thing for adoption, because so many wealthy people, would-be investors in Bitcoin, use Apple products. I personally got rid of my iPhone and got a Samsung because it was easier to use my wallet on an Android, but a lot of people aren't willing to take that step. Dish is another thing. I mean, it's a big, large corporation that realized, hey, this is an easy way to get paid for free. Yeah. Why not, you know, take it? And I think a lot of other people are going to do the same. You've heard John Donahoe from eBay talk about taking it. PayPal's CEO saying that he's long Bitcoin, which is a very interesting statement. And then, you know, if you look at the venture capital money over the last 3 years, it's amazing. In 2012, $2 million of venture capital money came into the Bitcoin startup world. Last year, $88 million came into it. And this year, and it's only June, we've already got $113 million. So people like Tim Draper, people like Mark Andreessen, people like Fred Wilpon, big, big names buying into it.
Yes, indeed. Big, big names are buying into it. To that list, add one more. June 11th, Expedia announces that they are now accepting Bitcoin from customers who want to purchase hotels through Expedia.com. I'll have a link to their announcement at Expedia.com. They talk about that at this time they're focusing on hotels on Expedia.com for now. Of course, I think CheapFlights.com is already allowing you to spend Bitcoin to buy your flight. So next time you go to California, you can buy all your hotels through Expedia.com using a Bitcoin. And why wouldn't a company do just like Expedia, set up an account with Coinbase and allow people to very easily conduct their transactions paying with Bitcoin instead of with a credit card or PayPal? The question is, what happens if you were to cancel a hotel reservation that was purchased using Bitcoin? Would you still be able to get the refund? They say, of course. Plans change all the time these days, and you shouldn't have to be locked into a hotel reservation just because you paid for it using Bitcoin. If a customer decided to cancel a room paid for in Bitcoin, she should receive a refund in Bitcoin. I think this is applicable to not only women, but men, provided the booking was for a refundable room. The refund would be based on the amount in U.S. dollars that was paid for a room, and Coinbase would refund the customer that amount based on the current Bitcoin exchange rate. So, you want to do a little Bitcoin arbitrage? You think the price of Bitcoin is going down? book a room on Expedia and then cancel it after the Bitcoin price has gone down and get even more Bitcoins in return. For example, let's say your room is $600. You spend one Bitcoin to reserve the room. Well, the Bitcoin price goes down to $300. You cancel the room. You now get two Bitcoins in return. What a great deal. Well, they don't have it available on a tablet or smartphone yet, but I like the fact that they're experimenting with it, and I hope people use it. Now, what about if instead you're booking a one-way trip out of the United States, revoking your U.S. citizenship? Here's another clip from Bloomberg talking about Roger Ver and his plan to help you in that endeavor.
Moving and shaking this hour, the investor known as Bitcoin Jesus. Yes, there's somebody known as that. Roger Ver is also known as an ex-con and an ex-U.S. citizen. Ver was one of the pioneers when it came to investing in virtual currency startups. Now he's willing to trade Bitcoins for citizenships. Ver says put down $400,000 in Bitcoins and you can get a passport to St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean. The island paradise has no taxes on personal income or capital gains. You may want to get some legal advice, though, before plunging into this deal and putting that money down. Last month, the Justice Department said that St. Kitts and Nevis passports were being used to facilitate financial crimes.
No. People go offshore to commit financial crimes? You mean people go offshore to hide from the U.S. taxes? People create accounts in the Cayman Islands in order to shelter tax from the United States? Unheard of. Let's turn now to CNBC, who interviewed Tim Byan, the BitPay chief compliance officer and former examining manager with Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, who discusses the growth of the Bitcoin ecosystem and believes Bitcoin is a digital asset being used as a currency.
How far have we come in terms of Bitcoin going mainstream?
So it's not imaginable, but Bitcoin ecosystem is so exciting today. There's so much growth, and I think it's just going to be light speed from here on a daily basis.
Obviously, BitPay hired you for a reason. So what do you think the biggest regulatory challenges are out there in terms of, you know, money laundering and the government getting in the way of the expansion of Bitcoin?
Well, I think most recently we've had some very negative or reputational issues in the Bitcoin community with Mt. Gox filing for bankruptcy, as well as the Silk Road being taken down. And therefore, compliance officers like myself, but more so the ecosystem players such as BitPay, want to establish a high standard in terms of anti-money laundering and terrorist financing. And so it's a priority for us to be good players, good citizens, and to really make Bitcoin not just a short-term prosperity, but to really be a long-term viable alternative payment system and alternative digital asset or currency.
I'd love to pick this, Brian Kelly, pick up right with that. You said it's a digital payment system. It's a digital asset. Is it a currency or is it an asset? And if it is an asset, we have all these other altcoins out there, alternative currencies that do different things. Are those a new investable asset class for Wall Street?
First of all, I believe that Bitcoin is a digital asset, but it's being used as a currency. So the ecosystem is applying different mediums and methods on how to use the Bitcoin protocol, including as a currency that can be quickly transferred at a very reasonable or nominal cost.
Is that topic getting a little tiring for you? The question of whether Bitcoin's a currency or an asset? Bitcoin is Bitcoin. Just get over it. Well, this breaking news just in, there's a Coinbase app out on the Apple iTunes App Store, but apparently it is not from Coinbase. It uses the Coinbase API. It's called Coinbase, but it's not actually from Coinbase. So beware, always beware. Read the details before you load or use a Bitcoin wallet on your iPhone. Well, how about one more topic before I let you go? You know, in the news this past week, Ghash.io became a 55% miner for Bitcoin. And this is something that has got the Bitcoin community all in an uproar because it, you know, it allows the potential for a 51% attack against Bitcoin, meaning that someone could potentially double spend their Bitcoin if they have the mining power to alter the blockchain. And Gavin Andreessen tweeted a link to this article at hackingdistributed.com, how to disincentivize large Bitcoin mining pools. I'll have a link to this article in the show notes. They talk about the fact that Ghash became a 55% miner for Bitcoin, and this collapsed the key value proposition of Bitcoin, namely its decentralization. In turn, there's been considerable criticism and backlash. Many people in the community, including us, have noted that etiquette or the goodwill of miners are not sufficient to keep monopolies at bay and are calling for technical measures to disincentivize large mining pools. The article is quite technical. They go into a specific technical fix called a two-phase proof of work to disincentivize large mining pools. And it's really quite a nice technical fix. It basically preserves the mining infrastructure. Miners won't have to change too much. They'll still be able to mine Bitcoin. But there's a slight change, and there would be, require a hard fork in Bitcoin eventually, so that the private key of the person that finds the block would have to be hashed yet again. And this would disincentivize someone from sharing their private key, basically, with the mining pool. They talk about there's basically two knobs to tweak, an X and a Y. The X is the original, the original hash that you're searching for. The Y then is the hash of the private key of the person that found the block. And you start out with Y being zero and X being what it is. And over time, you would gradually change the tuning of these two knobs to implement more of this disincentive for large mining pools to get in the game. So it would preserve the existing blockchain and the existing Bitcoin balances. It would preserve the investments many miners have made and are planning to make in their equipment. And it would provide a seamless transition from the existing system to the new one and provide these adjustable knobs that can be fine-tuned for a desired trade-off that fits the community's needs. Well, there are people working on solutions like this, and so it's quite feasible that this time next year, large mining pools won't have the monopoly power that they currently have in the Bitcoin community. Don't you just love technology? Don't you just love innovation? That's the great thing about the Bitcoin space, constant innovation. And it's what makes doing the Mad Money Machine so exciting for me. That is, being able to report on all these innovations, these technical innovations that great minds are coming up with. Well, this is Paul Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes millibits to make a mad money machine. I'll see you next Friday, June 27th at 3 p.m. In the meantime, buy some Bitcoin, spend some Bitcoin, go to Brocker.com and do that. Donate some Bitcoin by going to madmoneymachine.com and then replenish your Bitcoin. Send up a tweet, including at Mad Money Machine. You can email me, bitcoin@madmoneymachine.com, or call the voicemail line like no one ever does, 571-366-7121. Want to kind of keep the party rolling? This is the after show, the bonus extended content of the Mad Money Machine. You know, one of the things I was wondering about is, where are all the vuvuzelas? Is that the proper term for it? That were in the last World Cup in South Africa. Here's a little story about the new instrument that they tried to introduce in the Brazil World Cup.
The vuvuzela was the kind of horn used in the last World Cup that was in South Africa. And it was really noisy and it was so loud that people, that the players couldn't hear each other. And then it caused hearing problems with the audience. And now we decided to look after this new instrument to see if it's going to be a problem. This is the cacherola, a new instrument created by Carlinhos Brown, a musician from Brazil, and it's going to be the next FIFA World Cup instrument, the new noisemaker, or maybe the new vuvuzela. This was inspired in an instrument called cachixi from African roots, but it's used in capoeira, that's a very popular dance and fight in Brazil, and also used in samba. So it kind of mixed with Brazilian culture and our passion for football. The difference between the sound emitted by the vuvuzela and the cacherola, it's between 25 and 30 dB. And it's a huge difference. And for example, one vuvuzela, the sound pressure emitted by one vuvuzela in each of the ears, it's compared to approximately 2,000 cacherolas. We think the cacherola won't be as big, such a big problem as the vuvuzela. Although they tested it in a game, and it was a derby in Brazil. And then one team was losing a 5-1, and people started throwing the cacherola inside the field. So it's not dangerous for our hearing, but for our safety.
So the cacherola is this stupid little plastic shaker with, I don't know, beans in it or something. They were going to sell these things for $14. Oh my goodness, the gullible public. But they tested it at a match before the World Cup. They gave away several of these cacherolas, and people shake them merrily as the game was going on to no fun effect. And what they found out is when the refs made a bad call, the cacherolas soon became hand grenades, and people were throwing them on the field. Yeah, I guess hitting players in the head or whatever. And there was a video of people, you know, the players kind of sweeping the field with their feet to get the cacherolas off the field. Needless to say, Brazil decided to ban, and FIFA banned, the cacherola from their games. Oh my goodness, what a horrible failure at technological innovation. Maybe cacherolas will appear in 4 years made out of paper. Oh. But yeah, it seems like there's a market for an innovative, new, fun noisemaker to sell at an extremely high price at the next World Cup. So be thinking. I imagine whistles wouldn't do. The vuvuzela is not applicable, and the cacherola is just not fun enough. The plastic tubes that you beat together to make a banging noise, they're kind of, they've been done. So maybe a castanets? Who knows? Well, I'd like to leave you now with a song I just found on YouTube. This is the first time I've heard it. It's from Switchfoot. It's called Afterlife. I'll see you next Friday.
Tasted fire, I'm ready to come alive. I can't just shut it up and fake that I'm alright. I'm ready now, I'm not waiting for the afterlife. We'll be right back.
today. Is made every day. I choose my fate, and I wonder why.
Yeah!